case of internal bleeding. The only way I can leave is to die, right? In my mind, I was like, I should be able to get up on the stage and tell people the story in a way that they are able to see the funny in it the way I'm seeing it and experiencing it now. When jokes don't work, it's a tough feeling. There's never a guarantee. It's almost like you navigate the uncertainty with what you control in a way where you're keeping yourself alive. Be consistent, consistently good. Nothing can stop you. I'm sorry, but if it doesn't happen, is someone going to die though? No. No, work can wait, you know, because life cannot.
Without further ado, welcome, dear future creator.
This is actually a good starter point. What do you think about the Will Smith drama?
I mean, I think I side with most comedians, which is it's not the right thing, or it shouldn't have happened. So I'm a big fan of like fight words with words, ideas with ideas. So somebody said something bad, you know, he could have actually walked up, taken the mic, and then just gone after Chris Rock, you know, viciously.
Yeah,
he didn't do none of that,
because he used to be a comedian as well, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He could have literally done that, so, but he just went, it was emotional or whatever, so.
He's probably having a lot of things going on right now and we don't know, but yeah.
Yeah, not a fan. What really shocked me about that whole incident was people siding with Will Smith, saying that he was standing up for his woman, mm-hmm. and Chris Rock deserved far worse, and he's lucky that he got off with just a slap, and I was like, wow, there's actually two sides, because I was like, I thought it was just like, okay, this is just not happening. So it's almost like, oh, the joke was so bad that it justifies getting punished, and in fact, he should have gotten even more mm-hmm. hurt violently. I was like, okay, wow, that's a lot. That's just my perspective. So, yeah.
How would you have reacted in that instance as a comedian?
Oh, wow. Honestly, I don't think I would have been able to like, hold back, or you never know. It's like hypothetical, right? You might say, oh, I'll slap back, or I'll hit back, punch him in the face right there. But when it actually happens, maybe I'll just be quiet and walk away. I don't know. But I would say, like, watching Chris Rock, right? Like, he just like swallowed his pride and he stood there, just took it. To me, that's a sign that, like, if you look at his background, he had it tough, you know, he came up the hard way. You can tell, like, it's not the first time that he's been humiliated, mm-hmm. and he had to just silently swallow and take it. Like, he's been in that position several times. Nobody can do that just like that without having been that. So even after all this fame, he's like, this is the place I've been before. It's just that he's famous now and he's been put in that place. You could tell, feel that.
It as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was quite admirable when you see him basically react to the reaction in a, like, he's just looking at it and he's like, oh, he wants to say something, but he keeps everything inside of him. And it takes a lot of self-management in order
to
do so.
Yeah. It comes from past experiences. And like, he used to be like a dishwasher in the early days, struggling. Whereas if you take Will Smith, like, he was a child star, you know, he's 16, 17. He's already the biggest star in the country, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody knows him. So his entire life has been the life of a celebrity. Mm. Whereas Chris Rock has been a life of struggle and then he became a celebrity. Mm. So he knows what it is to hit rock bottom, be humiliated, passed up on opportunities, insulted. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whereas Will Smith's like, it's almost like this entitled brat, spoiled kid mm-hmm. all his life. So mm-hmm. does what he does kind of thing. And both of them are black men. You see the difference. So,
do you relate to Chris Rock?
Relate. I mean, I'm a big fan of this comedy, obviously. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much I can say relate. It's universal. A lot of his material and jokes, like, I think that's what makes him relatable to me, and I think to pretty much anybody who views
his jokes.
Comedy, because, like, even when he talks about black people or like experiences that he has, it's phrased in such a universal way. Mm. It just cuts across. It doesn't matter which country you're from or what religion or language. It just makes sense. Mm-hmm. And those kind of jokes are like, it's like comedy gold. Like jokes that just cut across universally. And Chris Rock was really, really good at that. Mm. Really good at that. So that's, I think that's what makes him one of the greats.
So we know a bit about the upcomings of Chris Rock. We know a little bit about Will Smith.
Yeah.
How about Deepu?
Oh, boy. So I'm from India, mm-hmm. city called Chennai in the south. Nice city. It's not a big city by Indian standards. Just about 8-9 million people mm-hmm. living there. So it's
not a big city at all. No?
It's kind of there. It's maybe the fourth or fifth or sixth, I don't know, biggest city. That's why I say 9 million tops. Mm-hmm. It's
just 16 times or 18 times more, or whatever.
Yeah. Pretty much, yeah. So it's got a nice beach. It's by the coast. It's in the south. Very hot, three seasons, hottest. So I don't miss that at all. So it's very humid.
Mm.
You sweat a lot, but it's a nice place. So that's where I grew up, and I always wanted to be a writer.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's still a dream.
Aspirations.
Yeah. I am a published author on Amazon Kindle.
Interesting.
Publishing, whatever. So,
okay.
So technically I'm already a published author, but it's like a flash fiction story, etc. But still, technically I'm already a published author.
Cool.
But yeah, so I think writing and words and storytelling really fascinate me. It's like if I were to like describe myself without a profession or like kind of education qualifications and things like who are you just as a person without like nationality or religion or things like that. I just like to tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
I love words, and I feel like words is like it's like you're creating something out of nothing.
Mm.
Like you have a piece of paper that's just blank, but you're able to like produce or like create words, and you put it down in that paper. It exists forever, you know? Like, mm. you created something out of nothing, and then that just endures. Just that, I think, is something that really fascinates me. It's very beautiful. And that's really what draws me towards, like, the written form.
Mm-hmm.
So I always wanted to be a writer and tell stories. And so when I was, I think, in my early 20s, I was like, oh, you know, someday I'll be published author. Oh, yeah, I'll write this novel. And, you know, which most people have is dreams. And people go on to do that maybe after they turn 35, 40. They're like, okay, now I can focus on my real passion, interest, whatever for a reason. So I think I was down that path. I used to have a blog or write a few short stories. I was a food blogger for a while, actually.
So interesting.
What I did was hilarious reviews of restaurants. So I was working with a regular food blogger. So we'd go to restaurants, eat food, and she would take pictures and then write a review of that, posted on like food websites.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would do a parallel story of that same experience, but it just like a hilarious version of it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was when I wasn't even interested in comedy. I wasn't even doing comedy at this point. So it was just like, I guess like, let me just talk shit about it, and people loved it. They're like, oh, this is, even the restaurants, they're like, oh, you do the funny version. Yeah, we like that. Even though I was like just roasting the food, I was like, you know, this chicken fell off, or I saw that goat running into the kitchen, or I just say some random stuff. They're like, yeah, do that. It's funny. It's good. So I did that for a while. So we're just doing random writing assignments for a fair amount of time. And then I had a spontaneous pneumothorax, which is basically a collapse of your lung when there are some air bubbles and it bursts. Typically happens when you have a knife stab wound, mm-hmm. or a gunshot. It's very common for the lung to collapse. Right. And I had none of those. I wish I had. That would be a cool story to say. The doctor said it's just that you're thin and tall and it can happen. So
because of like how, like your
the posture, morphology in the body, that's basically the reason, apparently.
All right.
So my lung collapsed and I had to get it operated, where they cut my entire rib cage up. And the lung is actually behind. A lot of people We think the lungs are right here, but they're right behind at the extreme. So if you want to get to the lungs, you got to actually go behind. And so I have a huge scar actually all over my upper back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a procedure for a few hours, and then I was in recovery in the intensive care unit. And it's just so happened that there was a case of internal bleeding. So blood was being drained out of my body into, like a chest tube drain. Usually it takes out like fluids, but in my case, blood was being drained. And I blacked out, and it was an emergency. And the doctor said, no, okay, we'll see. No, maybe, maybe not.
All right.
So, but somehow I pulled through, still alive. So kind of like on my second life, I guess.
How long was that, like the whole experience?
I was nearly a month in 3.5 weeks in the intensive care unit. So you have like high intensive care unit. That's what it was called, HIC, back in India, in Chennai. And that whole experience just the physical trauma and lying out there. It's like somebody placed a huge, huge boulder on your chest.
Mm.
So every time you cough, it feels like the biggest massive piece of rock is on your chest. You move, it's gone. So, and there's like an epidural line on the spine, which is, I don't know if you know what that is.
No.
But, it's basically a painkiller that's constantly like dripping that fluid right into the spine, so that your upper body, you don't feel as much pain. There's a lot of pain, but it kind of numbs the pain. So most common use, I think, is when like women deliver, and then right after pregnancy, it's like they have an epidural, right, and things like that. So anyway, this is like a very, very intense experience for me. And there was a person in the intensive care unit lying beside me who was coughing very badly, and his lungs were in very bad condition. And I was like, I just wanted to get out of that room. It's like 6-8 beds and 3 or 4 nurses and doctors on duty throughout 24/7 there. And I was like, I just want to leave. I just want to go home. I just want to go home. I can't take this anymore. And the person beside me, I woke up the next day and he was gone already. And he was in far worse shape. I was so pissed. I called the nurse. I said, listen, I'm in much better shape than him. How can you discharge him before me? It's not fair. And she said, no, around 3 a.m. he passed away. He died. I was like, great. The only way I can leave is to die, right? Basically, if I die, okay, I guess I'll just wait to die. And I was laughing. I was laughing so hard.
You were laughing about all that.
I was like, I'll just die. Fine, I'll also die. I was like, and I thought it was funny. I still think it's funny. I don't know why.
The nurse I'm laughing because you are laughing, man.
The nurse was stunned. She's just like, no, no, don't say that. Don't say you're going to die. I'm like, no, no, that's the only way I can leave, right?
Stop it, man.
And then the nurse was shocked. She walked away. And I was laughing so much for the next 30, 40 minutes. And my head, I was coming up with so many more jokes. I don't know, maybe it was the medication, it was the whole state, but...
Well, it's clearly not the medication because you're still laughing.
But I was able... So I knew it was not the most natural, obvious way to feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind, I was like, I should be able to get out when I get out, get up on the stage and tell people the story in a way that they are able to see the funny in it the way I'm seeing it and experiencing it now. So that was that urge that I know nobody finds it funny, but I want to tell it in a way on stage where people are able to come on that journey with me.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously I didn't do what I just said. It was a different set of jokes, etc., about hospitals and things like that. But that was really the trigger for me, that urge to tell the story and have people see it from my perspective, hopefully, and possibly laugh the way I did. So I think that's really been my
drive
to do comedy. It's like when I find something funny or I see something that I think is worth being made fun of, I was like, You see that too. Like, there's that urge not just to find that funny, but to take it to people and to bring them on on that same journey. A lot of people can be funny with friends or just as personalities, but when they're on stage, they're not as funny. You know, a lot of times people are like, oh, you're so funny, you should do comedy. And then they go to an open mic and they try doing comedy and then they fail miserably and they're like, oh, no, this is not for me. You know, it takes a certain type of personality or urge to be like, it's not just being funny. You need to have the urge to want to be heard. That's very important.
You want to have the urge to want to be heard.
You need to feel like, I have a story and I want to be heard. I want people to hear this. That's the drive that pushes you to share an idea that you have beyond just a friend or a partner. Most people have ideas and thoughts about traffic, the commute, a partner, wife, husband. Most people have ideas, but they may be discussed casually or a friend. Nobody's like, let me get on stage and tell it in front of like 200 people.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different switch in the brain, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To want to do that. So I feel like that's important if you want to meaningfully enjoy being a comedian. You got to want to be able to have that urge to tell that story to a lot of people. Is that
the only reason why you have that urge?
It's part of it, I would say. Part of it is also like getting up on stage. I think a large part of that is it pushes you to get up on stage versus maybe writing something or a funny tweet and things like that. But the other part is also you're creating a story, your version of a story, right? So let's say you go out there, you want to paint the scenery. You paint your version of it. I'm going to make the tree a little more green. Or this is the color I give the sky. You take pictures. You play with lens and filter. And so this is me taking an incident or a story, saying it my way. So it's like you're creating your own song, right? You know the chords. You have a certain skill, but you give that artistic outlet, right? And that becomes your creation. So that's I think, the more fundamental urge as an artist. And then there's that push that you have to want to be able to weirdly, for some reason, say it in a room full of strangers. So that's the weird path for stand-up comedy as opposed to just a musician or a painter or a singer and things like that. So,
Do you think it's more difficult to make jokes in regards to an audience that is more diverse? Because one could argue that when you do jokes about like a specific region, you can actually prepare about, okay, what are the traits of this specific region? What are their enemies? And, you know what I mean?
I would say it's both easy and difficult. I would say it's easy because there's a common experience or reference point that everybody has. Like, I'll give COVID as an example. Like, anytime somebody does jokes about COVID, it's universal, right? It could be in Japan, it could be in Peru. Everybody went through COVID the past 2 years, right? So when you do jokes related to COVID, it's like, it doesn't matter where you're from, it just cuts across. That's sort of the easy part, I would say, when it comes to doing jokes in Luxembourg. It's like, it doesn't matter where you're from. You live here, there's a certain context. You probably came here for work or followed a spouse or you grew up here. So there's a common context that you can tap into. That's the easy part. So whatever joke you do, you throw in a quick reference to say, you guys get it, we get it. Everybody in the room gets it. That's the easy part. The not so easy part is, I think, what you were referring to earlier, in the sense that a specific cultural reference that French people get might not land well for somebody from the UK or someone from Spain. So it's, you need to like make sure that you have sufficient jokes or punchlines. Okay, I know that three people in the room are going to get this specific pop culture reference from a US television series. But I have something from the guy from Krakow as well. So I'll get the Polish guy in the next joke or something. But you gotta have to have multiple angles and takes. So that's a nice way to develop or have more depth in jokes. Let's say I want to joke about something to do with getting coffee at a shop. I can come up with two or three jokes, but how is this going to land on someone who's 45 years old and lives in Metz and travels in and out? Versus how is that going to land with somebody who works as a counselor in an international school and moved from South Africa? You have both of them in the audience. So I think putting yourself out on stage in front of these kind of mixed crowds always pushes you to go deeper in terms of how you look at jokes, perspectives, things like that. So it's enabling, I'd say, to develop. Yeah.
Do you prepare for the jokes or?
The rule of thumb, the answer is yes. Everybody prepares. I think most comics, there's a joke within comedians. This is a very common question, by the way, that even audience members ask after a show. Hey, all of the stuff that you said, do you prepare or not? So you don't want to give away secret.
I'm good.
So what you do is, the common answer most comedians say is, it's a mix. It's a 50-50, and I prepare a little, and then I prepare. But it's mostly prepared.
All right.
If you're good at it and you've done a good job, you want to have it down to the very word.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always happen. And I can tell you I'm not good at it. I go off script or start riffing. But the whole idea is to prepare as much as possible. And the art lies in making it appear spontaneous.
Mm. Interesting.
Every sentence you say, or every joke you do, even if you're repeating that joke for the 50th time, you need to realize for the audience, it's the first time they're hearing that. It's the first time they're listening to that story. So you need to deliver that like you're saying it for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times you fall out of love with your story. I went there. It was like, you got to catch yourself, stop, and because you want to give the best version of that story for the audience. Mm-hmm. So it's always about that appearance of spontaneity. Make it seem like it's in the moment. It's like, I just came there. It's like, there's this other joke about how comedians get inspired. The day they get inspired is the other day. Because every joke starts with, so the other day I was, meeting this friend. So the other day, my wife was like, so that, when do comedians get inspired? The other day. When did you write that joke? Probably 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was like, the last week I was here. Sometimes I do a joke about, my last week my girlfriend broke up with me. After the show, someone comes and, hey, man, I'm really sorry. No, that joke was 6 months ago. It's fine.
I'm very sorry, man.
I did get dumped last week too, but it's unrelated. It's a different joke. I'm still working on it. Things like that. So, it's, you make it seem spontaneous. But there's also a lot of spontaneity with crowd work when you interact with the audience. Obviously, none of that is scripted.
Yeah.
But even there, you'd be surprised how much of that is actually prepared, in the sense that you have cards in your pocket that you decide to pull out based on how the conversation goes. Let's say I have like a random joke about Germans, something that I've written or thought about. And I happen to talk with the audience. Hey, where are you guys from? Oh, I'm from Munich. I'm just visiting my sister in Luxembourg. All right, I've got an angle there to bring in something that I've written, casually part of the conversation. But in that moment, people see that as a spontaneous response.
Exactly.
So they're like, wow. So in a way, it's like a magic trick. It's all about that perception that you're creating magic in the moment. Comedy is a lot like that, because you say a few words in a certain sequence. Mm. And at the end of that sentence, you elicit laughter. So it's like a spell.
Yeah.
You say a few words, boom, there's magic in the room.
Yeah.
That's what comedians do.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
So the thing that, so magic in the room, but the other thing which I'm quite interested about. How do you not fall out of love with your own story? You know, like telling the story all the time. And I guess it's not just the comedians, but I think comedians are the biggest ones. And then on top of that, you also have the fact that if you tell a joke and people don't laugh, like then you are questioning your own story.
Okay, there's two. So there's two questions.
So the first question would be, how do you not fall out of love with your own story and keep it spontaneous, basically?
It's not wrong. It's not a bad thing to fall out of love. Let me just say that. So it's almost like it has to run its natural course. So there's the part where you build up a story or a joke. So it starts off like a small idea. It could be just be one sentence. And I'm thinking of like a good example that I come up with.
Let's go on your TikTok.
Something that like evolved into a bit. Yeah, I can maybe give an example. So I had my bike stolen, and then what happened, and it's a real story, is that I called the police before they showed up. I found the guy. That was the real story. So the first joke that I thought of was, Luxembourg is so small, you know, you're going to run into them sooner than later. That was just a thought. It was an idea, more like a tweet of sorts. But then you take that, try it out, maybe it gets a chuckle. People are like, huh, okay. I'm like, okay, maybe there's something in there. Or you tell a friend and they're like, huh, yeah, that's so true. And okay, how do I work on it? It's like, of course you're going to find them. They're just four streets in the country. Okay, that's a little more punchy, a little more jokey. And then, okay, the police showed up and they're like, oh, you already caught him, so we can't catch him, arrest him, kind of thing. So it's like slowly we build some threads. And then I talk about how take away the stealing, that guy actually has got pretty good skills, you know. He takes risks, not afraid to get his hands dirty, sees opportunities where nobody sees. He's a go-getter, can-do attitude. Come on, hide this guy. So now I'm like just taking that one incident of having my bike stolen, but building that into like a huge set or a bit. So that part is the most, I think, lovely creative process because you're building something from scratch. So it's like pottery or sculpture. It's like you start with the first step, right? And then you're slowly building. That's a joyful experience. And it's easy because you know you're still in the process of creation. Once you have something that's set, okay, you've got a tight 5 minutes story, 5 minute story. You know, you're getting like huge pops, good laugh. Now what you do with it? This is when the fatigue sets in, because it's like, you don't want to be a machine on stage. You don't want to repeat the whole same story over and over. So you try and go with the energy. Sometimes in the middle of a story, there might be a reaction from the audience. Then we'll be like, ooh, or somebody might start clapping. So you let yourself go off the rails and dive a little in. Or you say, you know what I'm talking about. You look like the guy who's probably going to steal one of these bikes. So you get a bit playful. It's like you have the script and then you take the freedom to go off that. So that's the ways in which at least I try to keep the story alive for myself so that I know that my energy is still high, doesn't drop. The other ways of doing it is approaching it in a way where you change your whole attitude. So you say it in a very deadpan way, the entire story. So it's like you're trying to flex. The other way you say is like, you're completely surprised throughout the entire story. You're in disbelief yourself. So you just change the attitude that presents the story completely different. Yeah? So it's like filters on a picture, right? You post a picture, all right, another filter, now you play around.
Filter on the story, basically.
Something like that. So those are ways to do it. And like I said, it's not bad. It's not wrong to fall out of love. Which is when a lot of comedians put clips online. So we call it retiring your content. So the idea, the general principle is when you post content online, you're done with it. You typically don't do it on stage. I probably do it a few times, but it also depends how many views you get, right? Just like 14 views, you can continue doing it. No one's watched. It's fine. But it's like you got like 400,000 or a million views on a certain clip, you're definitely not going to do that same jokes at another show where people have bought tickets because they watch the clip. They're like, I like this guy. I want to see more of his jokes. You don't want to do those same jokes. You've retired those jokes. You want to work on new stuff. So that's a way of like putting to rest that content.
Mm-hmm.
So one, there's closure. Two, there's pressure to say, I need to write some new jokes now, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I can't fall back on the stuff that I already have. So you push yourself to come up with new jokes because you know you've already put it out in the universe.
Your favorite part is the creative process of creating the joke.
Mm-hmm.
Did I get that right, that you are basically, you're never 100% ready as you are creating the joke, but you actually test it out on the audience and the audience will kind of like tailor it to be, so based on the reaction of the audience, you will tailor it.
True. Part of it is testing out four or five different jokes or punchlines and seeing which ones land, which one don't, which one gets a stronger laugh. Sometimes you get a laugh, but it's weak.
Mm.
So you need to be strict with yourself and say, I know it gets a laugh, but I'm still going to remove it because I want huge laughs every joke. So that you're pushing yourself towards excellence. So that's one way based on feedback from the audience. But you're also constantly thinking, you know. You think of some idea, you write something down. 2 weeks later, you come back to that same idea with some fresh eyes and mind and like, okay, can I come at it in a different way? So I think it works in parallel. So You're constantly thinking about it and you're also taking in feedback from audiences and shows that you do week on week. And even when you get quote-unquote perfect joke or like the perfect set, nothing is perfect. It's not done. So in my opinion, the perfect joke is the joke that does not exist, in the sense that you can write the best joke, it can still be made better.
Mm.
You can add a little tag, there can be one word, another misdirection, something you can layer on top. Nothing is ever done.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that you decide to say, all right, it's done, you know? It's like cooking some kind of food recipe, you add in five ingredients, it's done. You could maybe add a little extra garnish, right?
Mm-hmm.
A little maybe some zest of lime or pop a little extra sort of like flavor. There's always that opportunity. Mm-hmm. So that's how I see jokes too. So.
I love that approach because it's basically you are not just reliant on you, but you're also reliant on the audience, which is the people that you are serving.
The people
that you're trying to quote unquote satisfy
with
your magic, essentially.
Yeah.
And if you think, like, I'm kind of relating to everything else in like the business world or any other creators, they're basically thinking about what they want to do without actually testing it out.
Yeah.
And then when you are actually releasing it to the world and no one has seen it, you don't necessarily know if it is good, but you believe that it's so you believe so much that it is good for you.
Yeah.
And well, then your whole like world shatters because of it. But in your approach, you're essentially testing it out as you go and you're building with the public.
True.
Which is what I admire that.
Yeah, it's like in business terms, it's like customer focus, right?
Yes, exactly.
So the customer is always right. Or the customer is always king.
King,
I'm butchering
right.
that, but it's one of those. But there's all that, even then there's like two aspects to it, because you want to take in feedback from the audience. You want to obviously get on stage and say something funny so they're able to forget about their hard day or just have a good time and laugh it off and enjoy the evening. But you also don't want to get into this spiral, downward spiral of pandering to the audience. For example, if you do jokes about how real estate is expensive in Luxembourg or traffic, like you mentioned, those are easy laughs.
Mm-hmm.
But if you fall into that trap of saying, okay, if I say something about French people being snobbish, most people will laugh. But that's not going to take you somewhere because you're just like going for the quickest, easiest, giving people what they expect. And end of the day, you'll become someone who's just delivering what people are asking for. But there's also an aspect where you want to introduce what you want to share and talk about to the audience. So it's like a delicate balance. I might want to talk about a certain experience which has to do with filling out immigration forms.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm Indian, when I go to the UK, there's a different procedure for me that doesn't apply to people with like EU passport, etc. It's a bit of a heavy topic and it's more procedural. Those are not the jokes people are expecting to hear when they come to the show. But it's a story I want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So I should be able to balance what I want to share, express as an artist, with what the audience typically expects out of the artist.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be one or the other. I can't be like, this is my story. I know it's sad, but listen to me. No. And it can't just be like, oh, you want jokes about something about Xavier Bettel? You want something about traffic? Okay.
I'll give you that.
It's a delicate balance of both. And honestly, that's what defines who you are as an artist. How much of what you choose, I think, is the journey that each comedian or artist has or creates for themselves.
So. Yeah, I love that because it's like, in what I'm thinking about is like, you know, there are thousands of self-development podcasts out there, but there's still an audience for each and every one of those because the host will be different to everyone and the host will always relate to this, to his story in relation to the guest's story.
Yeah.
And it's essentially the same thing with creators and with comedians, which are, who are always basically looking at what is it that the audience wants? How can I put my spice on top of that?
Yeah, true. It's always going to be a combination. And I would say really what differentiates or makes people stand out is not the part where you give the audience what they expect, but when you make yourself or the uniqueness from inside of you come out prominently.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what elevates, I would say, like the good from the great. So that's how it is.
So I have a question in regards to that, which is, how do you prepare your storyline? So I guess there is like, you cannot start off with like your best joke, right? You have to warm up the audience and then at some point, and then you have like an apex, just like any movie or story.
That's the plan. Sometimes you start with a weak joke and you think you close with a good one and that actually bombs and the good one was probably, the best laugh was probably the opening joke. You're like, what is happening?
So you have no idea of how to prepare, like not no idea, but you have no idea how to tell if that is going to resonate with the audience or do you have like a storyline?
There is a storyline, yeah, especially if you're doing like longer sets, like 1 hour shows or like solo performances. There is a storyline and you want to start with something that's strong because you're opening cold, right? So you want to hit them with some good laughs. And then the middle is usually where, you know, it's up and down, up and down. And then you want to close with a real good high and kind of like leave them wanting more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the general idea. I think it's like any kind of storytelling format. There's like the opening, there's a middle, and there's an end. So
yeah.
That is the typical storyline. A technique a lot of comedians use, and I personally, I think I'm biased towards, is the callback, which I don't know how do I explain this in simple terms. So it's basically a reference to a story or a joke from an earlier part of the show.
Oh, interesting.
So it's basic. It creates a reference, and just that reference in itself becomes a joke. And it's a safe way to close a set or a show a lot of times. So it could be at the end of the show, you reference that one joke again. So it's like, and then I walked in and I walked out and I ran into that same guy who stole my bike. But this time he was in a car. Some. I'm just giving some random examples. So people, because they're like, oh, I'm in the story. It's like an inside joke for me. So the audience feel like there's a more intimate connection. It's just, I'm doing a very bad job of explaining what it is, but it's called a callback.
And yeah, you're calling back on a previous part of the story.
Yeah, yeah. Either a story or a reference to an actual punchline or repeating the same phrase that maybe a boss or a mother said, say, how can you do this? And something, there's la ha ha la at the end of the show. And then I was like with my girlfriend and then I look at her and say, how can you do this? And the people, that phrase, okay, something like that. So that's a good technique, I would say, that people can use as part of the storyline.
Which is also one of those things where if you think about it, like I guess the reason why they are like so good is because they are already in the story. They're related to that and they know it.
Yeah.
And then they feel part of it. And if you feel part of it, you will enjoy it much more.
Yes.
I feel like this interview would be different if I wouldn't have seen you on stage first.
Oh, absolutely. You know, absolutely.
And you've made jokes about me, but I couldn't laugh.
Yeah.
So I think it would be different.
There's the context, right? If I just came in, we had never met and I spoke the way I spoke, you'd be still trying to like,
who is
it? Let's figure this guy out. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I would probably also be aware of that and be a little more like, okay, let's introduce each other.
Mm-hmm.
But we already almost like, it's like we're continuing a conversation that we had.
Exactly.
Which is how I feel when I speak to anybody after a show. It feels like, hey, we were speaking with each other for an hour. Are we just continuing the conversation now? It's not like I'm meeting someone after a seminar. If I was presenting a business seminar, people come up and introduce, hi, I'm so-and-so, this. You still have to break the ice.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you spent an entire hour or longer period in the room, you still have to break the ice.
Mm-hmm.
But after a comedy show, it's like, no, we're just continuing. It's a nice feeling.
Before, I had a question which I completely blinked, but it was the question, what do you do when people don't laugh? And I think the reason why I'm asking this question is because I believe as a comedian, and you tell me if I'm wrong, that you kind of develop a certain kind of resilience or like not really caring.
Resilience is bad.
Not resilience.
Resilience is bad. If a joke works, work harder, come up with a better joke.
Okay.
Resilience on stage. No, your job is to make people laugh. Okay. No point in trying to be like, yeah, you can't touch me. No, get affected.
So feel you get more
sad.
Soft?
Feel sad. You need to feel destroyed so you can go home and write better jokes and come back and not have that happen as much as possible. That's the, yeah. Sorry.
So you feel sad all the time. Well, not all the time.
When jokes don't work, it's a tough feeling. It's tough. I would say that's probably what makes performing comedy hard is there's never a guarantee. Even if some joke works 10 times and you know, okay, this is A+ material, it's like my safe guarantee, it will get laugh. It may not work the 11th time.
Mm-hmm.
And you have no idea why. So there's never a guarantee that things will happen a certain way. So part of it is, I would say, resilience in a way where you're like able to think on your feet, move mm-hmm. quickly. Let's say I have a story about going on a road trip and it's generally worked well. On a particular show, I start talking about it for some reason. 30 seconds in, there's still no laugh. 1 minute in, maybe a chuckle. What I need to be able to do is if I have like 10 jokes, so to speak, in that story, I should be able to quickly think, okay, joke number 3 and 7 are the biggest laughs. Let me make the story super short. So I just hit 3, 7, and boom, jump to the next joke. So this needs to happen in real time. And you need to have a map of which are the jokes you think might hit or work better. And quickly shift gears. So it's that mental agility that you have on stage to decide what works, what doesn't. Sometimes you may not even have that fallback jokes. All of it might just bomb. So you just go to something else or you go into the crowd. That's a technique that people use as well. If your scripted jokes don't work, start talking to the crowd. And there's always a little more leeway because people know you're spontaneous. So it doesn't have to be over the top funny. Even if it's like half hilarious, you're rewarded with laughter because people know it's in the moment. So there's the bar, so to speak, for release of laughter is a little less. So you're rewarded for that spontaneity more than the rigor of joke writing. So that's a good technique too. I personally have what I call saves. So if a joke doesn't work, I pretend to like look at my notes or I say, you know, that joke usually works in a room where people have master's degree or something like that. Just like a put down and people are, oh, you know. Or I say, no, some geez, don't worry, you'll get it eventually, like COVID or something. And then so I have like few of these saves. I think that's more like a personal style that I have. Or if there's a joke that gets like, ooh, I just look at my notes saying, the joke's good, the audience suck, or something like that. So it's not really a joke, but mm-hmm. it's a good way to acknowledge that, hey, I know it failed. I'm not in my own bubble. But let's be playful and move along. So without dropping the energy, mm-hmm. that's the worst thing that can happen when you say something. And then he said this. And you wait, and you're waiting for the laughter, and audience is like, oh boy, were we supposed to laugh? Audience is uncomfortable, you're uncomfortable. Usually, like when you're like new to comedy, people deliver the joke and then they're like,
they're waiting.
They're waiting. It's not a bad thing to wait. Sometimes it's like a dark joke. You can give that couple of seconds, hold the tension before it breaks. But sometimes you just know the joke doesn't work. The mm-hmm. people are like, give me something else, give me something more. So you need to be able to move quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something a lot of comedians do. You would be surprised, even the best comedians, the shows they do, you'd be surprised at how many jokes don't work. But the audience, they don't catch it. Other comedians will, because we know written to get a joke. Oh, that didn't work. But when you watch as an audience member, you will not catch it because they move so quickly past that. When something doesn't work, they quickly shift. So it feels like, he's just continuing the story. No, he knows there's two jokes that bombed. Or she knows the two jokes that bombed.
Mm-hmm.
But they're able to maneuver quickly. So that's also part of the art of the performance mm-hmm. and things like that.
So how would you describe that uncomfortable feeling when you are when a joke bombs to an audience that has never done stand up? Is there any feeling like?
That's actually a good question. That's a good question. I can actually probably even come up with a whole bit about it, trying to explain it. So I'm gonna think about it a little more.
My thought was a girlfriend dumping you.
No, it's the key element is there's nowhere to hide. You can't leave. You have to stay and hold ground.
Oh, yeah.
It's even so much different from a theater performance. Let's say I'm in a drama play,
mm-hmm.
Macbeth, and I'm playing a character. I can give the most spectacular performance of my life. The audience loves it. They hate it. I have no clue. Because there's not interaction after every single sentence. At the end of the show, maybe there's applause.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the show, whether they enjoyed it or hated it, is mostly non-reaction.
Yeah.
So I can get away with just doing whatever I do, leave. With comedy, every single minute, are they laughing? Are they not? Are they listening? Are they not? You know? So it's like this anxious undertone mm-hmm. that's there throughout. And if something fails, not only do I know it, everybody in the room also kind of gets it. And I'm like, I can't run away.
Mm-hmm.
It's like being given feedback. Hey, your performance hasn't been good this year. All right, I'll work on it and, come back. No. Fix it now. We'll watch.
Yeah.
That's comedy. So yeah, it's you have to take in that rejection, and you can't even be like, oh man, there was no. People are watching. Continue. So I still don't have an analogy, but I'm just describing.
But it's good.
It's good.
No, I wouldn't come up with an analogy because I feel like we can always run away, and that's why I like comedy. I feel like I am tremendously admire comedians because they don't just get to be there, but they actually get to get rid of all the past and next one. And I think it's the same. Like we started out with Chris Rock, we go callback. I'm applying here comedian style, callback. if we think about Chris Rock, it was he was shook. He took his seconds, but then he continued on, gave the price, and that's it,
Yeah.
Obviously, it wasn't about making other jokes, but actually, he did say something. All right, this was the greatest moment in history.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still related to that situation, and
he was still able to bring a little bit of levity and some sort of lightheartedness to that situation, even though it was, whoa, what just happened? He was able to play it off, saying, That's the biggest some moment. I don't know what he said, like the...
Yeah, it's the biggest, greatest moment in
television history. Yeah. And he was like, that was him, I think, metaphorically laughing it off in the moment. But he was able to do that. That's what so I think that also comes with like instincts, like comedic instincts. Like when you've been doing it for so many years, getting up on stage night after night, I think mentally it's like a reflex of something drops, you catch,
mm-hmm.
right? Even if your hand is like sprained or hurt, you just have that reflex. So it's something like that. So
mm-hmm.
it was pretty interesting to watch.
Yeah. Where do you stand on comedy right now? So is it like a passion? Is it something that you would like to do like full time? Because I know I've seen you on TikTok now. I've seen your life.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm still a pup in the game, as I like to put it. So in the sense that pretty much a newbie. I think in Luxembourg, people for good or bad, they're like, oh, this guy, oh, he's a pro, he's a comedian. But no, I'm a nobody. Honestly, I'm a nobody.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I am, I think, in terms of where I stand.
Where do you see this going?
As a comedian. I think the dream and the ultimate goal is to spend more and more time and energy with comedy, with writing, and even teaching, I would say.
Teaching comedy?
Or just teaching in general.
All right.
So those are really things that energize me. In a strange way, I would say like the day job that I have is actually like tapping into that energy.
All right.
Although not directly. Because I work in leadership development and learning and development. So in some way, that's like that passion is kept alive in a different context. But yeah, the dream and the goal is to spend more time, effort, and energy here. The whole conversation about full-time, part-time, and people, oh, do you want to do it full-time? Do you want to do it? I define it as, like, where are you spending most of your energy and time? Like, when you say full-time, what does it mean? Is that mean that's your primary source of income?
Mm-hmm.
Or is that where you spend most of your waking hours and time and energy? There's different ways to look at it. Or is that where you define success for yourself? I could be a great father or a great comedian. Which one is more important? Or are both equally important? So the question of full-time is, I think, is a bit of a misnomer. So is it just about where you're spending time or getting money or where you define success for yourself? Or it could be a combination of all three. So I don't have like a direct answer saying, yeah, I'm gonna do this by this. It's show business. That's also something that's both fascinating and hard. Because in a regular career, say in a corporate world, there's a steady progression, right? Start off as a junior analyst, you become an analyst, or you got like roles like administrative assistant, then it's like senior something. You go through vice president, director. There's a path, and it's usually a linear progression over several years, and you go through that. With the creative pursuits like comedy or acting, you could be doing auditions for 20 years and not have a break. And then boom, in 2 years, you could be signed up by like Disney.
Yeah.
And your life changes like this.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might never happen. And most likely, it won't. That's your business. You know, so it's, I would say, a bit naive also to think, yeah, I'm going to do this, and this is going to happen. So you got to be very careful about what you define as success. A lot of times, I've seen artists, even comedians, have one singular goal. That's really far out, and all of their success and reward energy is based on that one. So it's almost like they're unhappy and discontent because they're constantly chipping away at that goal. When actually you can have multiple goals that you keep rolling along to get there, as long as you're doing that. So that's kind of how I try to like see my journey. So it's almost like you navigate the uncertainty with what you control in a way where you're keeping yourself alive. And you're also pushing yourself towards excellence. So for now, a lot of the goals that I think I have for this year or the next year is to put out a lot more online content, which I traditionally haven't focused on. It's like been like a weak area for me. But I want to push more and more into that area. So it's like it's just even like micro goals, like, okay, making sure that I'm posting a clip every week, 2 reels that go on Instagram, at least making sure there's like 7 to 10 tweets a week. So those are like very tactical goals where I'm like, I'm able to do that consistently for 6 months. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Reach. That's a different goal where I have a little less control over what I do because that's focused on output, right? Mm-hmm. It's not the input that I'm getting. So I'm going to have to navigate that slightly differently. Maybe I'm not as successful on that. Maybe I will. So it's just how you're able to break down the journey that you want to go on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my answer to full-time.
No, I love the answer, especially the fact that you are like essentially looking it towards what you can control, and like the consistency is probably the biggest part.
Yeah.
From what my creative journey and my creator journey.
Yeah.
I know that when I took a break from the podcast, obviously like the listenership is only going to come as much as when you are consistently putting out, and like,
yeah,
obviously, yeah. Then obviously we are here in data minded. Like everything is controlled by data. So you see all the graphs going up and then you stop. So consistency is probably the biggest part of the whole journey.
And I fully agree.
And having fun.
Yes. I mean, like, if you're not having fun as part of the process,
you shouldn't be doing it at all.
There's nothing. I forget who said this. I think it was a comedian. I forget who it was, but I think it goes something on the lines of being consistent, consistently good.
Mm.
So it's not just like mediocre content. Be consistent, consistently good. Nothing can stop you. Mm-hmm. Like it's like success is guaranteed. It might take time. It might come in 2 years. It might come in 10. But if you're consistent, consistently good, people will come in search of you. It's like, why is this person not big? Like, come on, we got to blow them up. Like, people will come and put you on a pedestal. It's like, how is this? How does people not know? Because audience members, they love discovering artists before they're big.
Mm-hmm.
You know? People were like, when they see a big artist, I knew that singer, I knew that band when they were playing for 50 people. Now they're at Coachella. I was with them. I discovered them way before. Audience members love discovering new artists who are on the up and rising. So you always got to tap into that. So if you're consistently good, it's just a matter of time.
Just a matter of time. I love that.
Yeah.
So how has comedy shaped you as a person?
Saved a lot of money in therapy. Okay.
Money and therapy.
No.
So still money and therapy as well.
No, I think it's the like a running joke that comedy is like a replacement for therapy. So you don't have to go see a therapist. Just get in a room in front of people and you can do it for free, kind of thing.
Mm.
But how has it shaped me as a person? One, I would say it's made me more and more less, I'll rephrase this, but less tolerant to bullshit.
Interesting.
In the sense that comedians are so trained to see things or like call out hypocrisies that happen around us. That's kind of also joke structure. You know? This doesn't add up. And not just like, oh, yeah, that's so true. Yeah, I thought about it. Oh, yeah. So you're trained to start thinking like that. So you always call out things for what they are. So there's like a very healthy cynicism, I would say. It's not negative, cynical, oh, everything is bad, but you're able to critique things or see through and call things out for what you are. So it's a very direct, I wouldn't say honest, but a very, it's like keeping it real. And I think that grows on, it grew on me as part of my personality that I probably wasn't as much that previously, but now I'm like, gotta keep it 100% real. There's no fake pretend kind of thing. It's like, this is it. And that authenticity is usually rewarded because people are like, okay, this guy's a real dude, you know. This person is like, okay, what you see is what you get.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a nice feeling. It's a nice feeling. I would say that's probably one big way in which my personality has been affected by comedy. The other, I would say, is you also realize almost everybody, we're playing characters. It's like that Shakespeare quote, right? Like, all the world's a stage. And we're all nothing but players, you know, we're just actors. So in like a professional work context or if it's like any kind of series, like I'm always able to like break the eyes or step out of that character. You know, all just, it's like, I like people who don't take themselves too seriously and also who don't take me too seriously. So it's not to say that disregard me, but nothing in life is just worth being too serious about, and this is life or death matter kind of thing. You know, someone says something like, but did you die though? Is somebody dead? No. So relax. Like when people take their jobs so seriously, oh, I have to send this report. Oh, I have to send this Excel by this the email. I'm sorry, but if it doesn't happen, is someone going to die though? Are you working in an emergency room? No. Life can, no, work can wait, you know, because life cannot. There's always going to be more work. There's always going to be some tasks to do. There's never ending, but life is what you create and live every day. So just that little bit of playfulness, right, in life, I think can make you see things a bit differently. So I derive that playfulness, I think, from my comedy. So there's also that, I don't know who has this quote, but the creative adult, I think so, I'm probably phrasing this badly, but the creative adult is the person who did not let the inner child die. Something on those lines, I think. So a lot of times I think we let that inner child die. So keep that alive. And I think we'll be a more fuller version of ourselves as adults. At least that's my belief. That's my belief. And I had like a personal experience with my dad, who passed away a few years ago with cancer. And it was all sudden. It happened in a few months from the diagnosis to him passing away. And for a long time, I had a lot of guilt because I was like, oh, I couldn't take care of him, or I didn't spend enough time. I didn't know it was going to happen so quick. You know, a lot of those kind of feelings, which I think a lot of people who've cared for patients with cancer express. And one of the things that, for me, a takeaway was the fact that, you know, goals and work and things can wait. Life cannot. So make sure you live life to the fullest. So if there's like somebody calls you for drinks on a Friday evening and you're like, no, I got to do my laundry, or no, I have food at home and I don't want to go out, you'll forget whatever the task that you're placing as important. In maybe 2 weeks, you're like, wait, what was it? Why did I cancel? You won't remember. But if you say, go out and have a good time, 6 months later, maybe even 2 years later, you look back like, oh man, that Friday evening, we had such a good time. You remember that. You know, so try to do things that you know that you can remember several years later. If you're going to forget it in like this, it's probably not the best use of time.
Mm-hmm.
So sorry, I turned this into a TED talk, but yeah, that's my.
No, you actually, you know, like you actually gave me a little bit more perspective because I'm the guy that says no to their friends quite a lot. I'm sorry. They know it because I'm constantly working. But yeah, like with the whole conversation, with the whole example, you kind of gave me a little bit more perspective on actually saying more to them. Yes to them.
Cool.
So I appreciate that, actually.
I'm glad.
Actually, I've never asked this question before.
Please.
What is a question that you would like a question that you don't get asked, but you would like people to ask you?
Ooh. When you and I think about the question, all I'm thinking of, these are the questions that I don't want asked. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So it's like, not this. But wow, I never quite think about what I want as to be asked. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I don't know.
The question that I ask, like I've thought about it, mm-hmm. and I use it in my coaching sessions sometimes is, you know, when you have like a meetup, you say, hello, how are you doing? It's like, oh, I'm all good, all good, all good, good. And then it's like, how are you really doing?
Mm.
And that kind of like shifts the whole energy because there's always way more going on inside of you than you're actually leaving out.
True. Yeah.
So how are you really doing?
That's a good question. Yeah. I think it goes straight to feelings and emotions. I would say, to kind of answer the question, right now I feel like I am between two flights. So it's like, and it's like I'm at the airport. It's a transfer. There's like 1 hour 40 minutes before I make it to the gate. But I'm still waiting to collect my bags. And I don't know if it's going to be this flight or is it going to be a different set of plans where I just walk out of the airport. If that analogy makes sense.
It makes sense to me.
It's a bit of a riddle, but...
It makes sense to me. We'll see if the audience gets it. We'll see if the audience gets it.
That's how I'm feeling. I actually use a, sorry to continue, but I use a different question, similar, I would say. But I go with, like when I message or call someone, I go with, how are you feeling today?
Mm.
Instead of, how was your day? I go, how are you feeling today?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I feel like you've given us already a lot of advice and a lot of perspective.
Oh boy.
About life. And then
it's funny because you wanted to be a teacher. I came in. If you said, you know, you're going to give advice and perspective, I'm like, get the fuck out of here.
Well, what
perspective am I going to? I just get on stage, tell jokes. That's a fun conversation. But it looks like it just goes in a
shifting
way, right? So, yeah.
So you actually did give a lot of perspective. And right. Like for me, and I think that the audience will love it as well. Will definitely, like in terms of like for creators and for like how the journey of a creator can be improved in a sense. Also throughout the whole like feedback loop, callbacks, and like looking at your own story. I think that there are different perspectives where you can look at like a comedian and like put it into your own art.
Right.
In the end, we are all art, but at the same time, you have like your own life stories. And the life story is the thing that will make your story yours. And it's where the whole perspective comes from. Why is it that you did or do what you do right now? Yeah. So yeah, it's because of how you are and what you happened to you and that you developed into the person that you are today. And I mean, that gives a lot of perspective for a lot of people that are creators, but also for a lot of people that are comedians who went through a similar story than you did.
True.
So the last three questions of this podcast are always the same ones.
Okay.
What is the worst advice that you've ever been given?
Worst advice I've ever been given. I don't know if it's an advice, but I hate this quote, everything happens for a reason.
Ooh.
I hate that. I think that's probably the worst piece of advice, to just like take that as a logical...
As a justification.
Justification what happens.
For what happens.
Everything happens for a reason. I'm like, no, no. That's probably the...
All right. Worst piece of advice. I love that. What is the best advice that you've ever been given?
Or what is
your favorite quote?
Best advice ever been given. I'll just give it's probably not the best. It's hard to like say what's like the best piece of advice. But I think something that stays with me. This is more of, it's probably not even the best, but just the dedication or rigor that you have to, like, into whatever energy that you put into whatever that you focused on. So it's, see, you know, the sociology, it's just a quick anecdote. Sorry, I know it's like rapid
go
fire, but
go for it.
Sociologist named Max Weber.
Hmm.
Am I saying that right?
Yeah, I think so. In English, you are saying it right.
Yeah. How do you say that in German?
Max Weber.
Weber. Yeah. So in English, typically it's Weber.
Hmm.
Weber. But my professor, when he was teaching us, he encouraged us to say it, I think, the German way.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Max Weber,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm obviously not getting it 100% right, but it's the attempt.
You're doing it just fine.
And he said, people can ask, oh, it's a proper noun or it's a name. You can say it any way you want. And he said, if we sociologists don't say it right, who will?
Mm.
It's just a very random anecdote. But for me, that's so telling of how you should approach yourself. So no one's watching you. There's no standards to set, or like whether it's like being morally, ethically right, or integrity, professional, anything. It could be anything. But it's like, if you don't do it, who will? So that should define the labels you assign to yourself.
Mm.
It might not be sociologist, but if it's like, you know, comedian, podcaster, a chef, a driver, like if you can't be a version of whoever you are, that people be like, that's something.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even the best.
It's not the best.
It's just you that's so distinct. That's like, if you don't do it, who will?
Mm.
For me, that's like, it's something that inspires, you know? So it's not an advice, but I generally gravitate towards ideas that give you energy and purpose. So next question. Sorry.
Love that. What is the advice that you would like to leave the audience with?
It's better to, this is an advice actually, I think, that came from a famous CEO who we shall not name, but it's better to be kind than clever. I think that's probably what I would put out there. I got this in a different way from another comedian a couple of years back when I was trying to write jokes, and they were mostly witty jokes.
Mm.
And he asked me a question. He said, Deepu, do you want to be clever or do you want to be funny? What are you trying to do? So that was again like a big moment for me. Like, what am I really trying to accomplish? So yeah, I think so. I equate funny with kindness.
Mm.
So it's a lot more better for the world to be more forgiving then punishing and then trying to say, oh, this was not right. Every time I get on stage and tell a joke, I don't even know if I'm saying the right thing, the quote-unquote right thing. So it's a lot better as a world to be more forgiving than punishing in general. So don't be hard on yourself. Don't be hard on others. We're all learning every day, you know? You're not the person you were 10 years ago. You're going to be a very different person 10 years from now, you know? So just take it easy on yourself. Take it easy for others. And hopefully that'll make the planet better place. Sorry, I have to end on a feel-good note.